Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The idea of martyrdom and persecution is a widely held Christian tenet, and the idea that Christians are uniformly discriminated against today by a hostile and secular world is a common creed occur in our ongoing culture wars. But my guest today argues that this notion of Christian victimhood has actually been carefully honed over centuries and centuries, going back to the original stories of early Christian persecution in Rome. In fact, she says, many of those stories of persecution and martyrdom were largely exaggerated or fabricated to inspire the faithful, fight heresy and dissent, and fund individual churches. Incidentally, she says, contemporary stories of Christian persecution do exactly the same thing. Canada Moss is a leading scholar on Christian history and the professor of New Testament and Early Christianity Studies at the University of Notre Dame in South Bend, Indiana. She has written a fairly controversial book, The Myth of Persecution, How Early Christians Invented a Story of Martyrdom. It's published by Harper One Press. She urges Christian readers to abandon an us-versus-them mentality in the book, and that while these martyr stories may have been embellished or created, the teachings derived from them can still provide moral guidance and deep spiritual consolation to Christians. It's a fascinating book at Early Christian History, The Myth of Persecution. Canada Moss is my guest today. Canada Moss, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
This book, The Myth of Persecution, for some Christians, it's going to be a very controversial book because you argue that the age of martyrs in early Christian history was largely invented. Before we look at those accounts, let's just touch on this idea of the, quote, myth of persecution. Why is this important to 21st century Christians?
Well, it's not just a question that this is what people grow up with, although they certainly do. I, like a lot of Christians, grew up with this idea that in the earliest days of the church, Christians were hounded and tortured and killed merely for their faith in Jesus. And that idea actually still persists today. So Christians still talk about how they are persecuted by definition. They'll say things like, Jesus predicted that we would be persecuted, and we were. Look at the apostles, look at the early church, and we're still persecuted today. And more often than not, when people talk about how they're persecuted today, they're talking about disagreements about lawmaking or disagreements about how society should be run. And the problem with that is that persecution language implies hatred. You can't really negotiate or collaborate with your persecutor to run society. So when we talk about being persecuted in modern society, we're basically shutting down dialogue. We can't really make progress or really run society properly when we're constantly complaining that those who disagree with us are persecuting us.
And in fact, the whole idea of the word persecution suggests that you are being punished unjustly. So that means that your opposite side in the conflict are obviously unjust. You're in the right, they're in the wrong.
That's right. It's very black and white, and it's very polarizing. It's us against them. It's good against evil. And when you frame debates like that, then you don't really have to listen to the arguments of the other side, and you don't have to consider the ways in which your own arguments, even if they turn out to be right, might themselves seem harmful to people. So you're not really allowing for sort of legitimate, well-intentioned disagreement.
Now, as I understand it, the origins of the idea of this book really began with a couple of homilies you heard.
That's right. I was in church and I heard some homilies that were comparing modern political sort of activists with the apostles and talked about how they were persecuted by society and how they might even be called upon to die like the martyrs. And when I heard that, I thought, well, that's a little extreme. And I sort of wondered, who else is everyone else if these particular political advocates are martyrs? Who is everyone else in society? Are they persecutors? And after that, I just started to see this language of persecution everywhere. My students would tell me that they thought that Christians were persecuted, not just in the early church, but today. And people would say that when they were teased or ridiculed for being Christians, that they were being persecuted. And that seemed to me to be overstating the situation. It's not nice to be ridiculed. It's not nice to be teased. But that's very different than, say, being thrown to the lions. And I realized that the only way that people could really claim that being ridiculed was persecution if they thought that Christians were sort of by definition persecuted, if there was something about Christians that made them vulnerable to attack, or if there was something about claiming to be persecuted that somehow gave you power in a debate. And the origins of this idea and the origins of these kinds of claims really go back to the history of the early church. So I thought, well, let's look at that and tell people what I as a scholar know and what other scholars know, and explain that there really was no systematic persecution in the early church.
There were times of persecution, but
Yeah, there were.
But I think when most Christians, to the degree they think about it at all, they tend to think of martyrdom and persecution as pretty much an ongoing, widespread, ongoing, genocidal sort of persecution over the first 300 years of the church. And as you write in the book, you said evidence is suspect, to say the least.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That is what people imagine. We imagine genocide. We imagine people being hunted down and dragged out of their houses at night to be tortured and killed. And we imagine that as a sort of a continuous, systematic persecution of Christians that lasted centuries. There were brief periods of persecution, but those lasted no more than 10 years in total, that kind of persecution. And I think we really need to ask ourselves if those brief periods actually add up to the kinds of sort of 2,000 years of victimhood that we've gotten from that period.
Now, also, you look at martyrdom, too, which this is, I don't know if it's the most controversial thing in the book, but it's certainly one of the things that is somewhat controversial. Christians would most say that martyrdom was a practice that originated with Christians. Christ, the first example, the apostles later. And you write that, in fact, there was a well-known tradition of what you write as noble death, or dying for one's belief well before Jesus was born. How well was that known in the ancient world?
That's right. Actually, you know, this is so counterintuitive to us because we go to such lengths to stay alive. But in the ancient world, life was very fragile. People were dying all the time from disease, in wars, from natural disasters. And so people in the ancient world thought a great deal about what it means to die well and how you would like to die, given that life is fleeting. And they idealized certain kinds of death. So they idealized dying in battle, in defense of your country. They idealized dying for your principles, for your city, and for God. And, you know, they have very elaborate understandings of exactly what that kind of death would be like, this honorable, good, or noble death, they called it. And there was something particularly noble about choosing that kind of death, sort of electing that kind of death. In defense of something greater than yourself. So there were people like Achilles who chose to die young and for glory and fame rather than live a long life and died at Troy. There was the great philosopher Socrates who could have gone into exile, could have accepted or tried to ask for a lesser sentence than he received, but stayed in Athens and actually drank poison in order to die honorably in defense of his principles. He wouldn't run away. He was brave and courageous. And there are Jewish examples of martyrs who, rather than, say, eat pork or break the Sabbath, were willing to be brutally tortured and killed for the sake of the laws of their ancestors. And so in the ancient world, you would have been hard-pressed to find someone who didn't think that this kind of death was preferable to sort of dying sort of anonymously late in life. Pretty much everyone idealized this kind of death.
And you were talking about, you sort of connected the dots between noble death and martyrdom, which is the very fact is that we remember martyrs. We remember Joan of Arc. We remember Martin Luther King or Gandhi in the political realm. We remember a martyred death.
That's right. We do. We do remember these martyrs. It's interesting, you know, when Achilles dies so that he will always be remembered. That was one of the things he was offered, and he has been remembered. And we do use martyrs today in politics. So in French politics, Joan of Arc is claimed by multiple political parties who have very different opinions from one another, who think that they represent the France that Joan of Arc defended. And you'll often hear in modern politics, people will talk about, just the other day, Glenn Beck said that he stood with Martin Luther King. I don't know if Martin Luther King would feel that way, but he does. And that's one of the amazing things, that Martin Luther King can be claimed by people from all different kinds of positions. And what's interesting about that is how aligning yourself with martyrs gives you power. It says, I'm on the side of righteousness and justice and God, just like the martyrs.
I was really fascinated with some of these early martyrdom stories, and especially Socrates, because he seemed to be, in the accounts of his death from Plato and other Greek writers, seemed to be pretty influential on early Christian writers as well, and their audience of converts or hopeful converts.
That's right. In fact, you know, the death of Socrates, which is perhaps the most famous death among people living at the time of Jesus, actually influenced, some scholars think, the writing of the death of Jesus. That kind of death, that kind of sort of calm, philosophical death, influenced particularly the author of the Gospel of Luke. And in fact, there are other early Christian writers who will explicitly talk about Socrates. There is an early Christian martyr who describes Jesus as a teacher sort of in the style of Socrates. And a lot of early Christians present themselves as sort of being like Socrates and dying the kind of death that Socrates died. And it's amazing to think that martyrdom, which some people think is sort of unique to Christianity, or at least beginning with Christianity, actually was sort of adopted from Greek and Roman myths and stories about the death of philosophers.
Yeah. And in fact, you contrast the stories of Mark and Luke. Luke seems to be, I think you quote some second century Roman person who looked at Mark's account sort of disdainfully because Jesus is, you know, very anguished in that story. And it doesn't fit with that concept of noble death as well.
Yeah, that's true. The way Jesus is in Mark in the Garden of Gethsemane, he's very anxious about dying. And then on the cross, the last thing he does is cry out to God. That's tremendously reassuring to us because he's very human and we can understand his emotions there. But to people who were sort of well-versed in these kind of ancient models of death, like Socrates, who dies silently, they sort of found this a little bit embarrassing. They couldn't understand. It sort of sounded a tiny bit weak that Jesus would be so upset. And so the author of the Gospel of Luke and lots of second century authors, they based the stories of the death of Jesus and the martyrs on models like Socrates, you know, sort of manly, macho models of dying. They're a lot like sort of modern action heroes. You know, they're controlled, they don't feel pain, they have these sort of pithy one-liners, and they're very manly. And that was sort of, in the early church at least, that was the kind of death people wanted to see a hero die.
My guest today is Kanda DeMoss, a professor of New Testament studies at the University of Notre Dame. She's a specialist on New Testament and early Christianity studies. Her new book is titled The Myth of Persecution, How Early Christians Invented a Story of Martyrdom. It's published by Harper One, and she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, let's delve into some of these stories of martyrdom. You know, just last Sunday from my pulpit, I heard the story that 11 of the 12 apostles died for their beliefs. You, in the book, really have six accounts of what you call, in quotations, so-called martyrs, and there was an apostle among them.
Right.
So where do these stories of martyrdom come from?
Right. Well, the interesting thing is, so there are the people who died. And I would say with the apostles, I have no reason to think they didn't die. They're certainly not alive today. And it seems likely that they did die violently. Then there are the stories. And the stories come from much later. So in the case of the apostles, as late as 100 years later, And with the apostles, the stories are written in the style of ancient romance novels. They're filled with sort of Harry Potter-style wizard competitions and flying magicians and resurrected smoked fish and talking animals, things like that. So they're sort of fanciful and playful. And the interesting thing is, what I learned growing up was the apostles died for their faith in Christ. I learned, for example, that the apostle Peter was crucified upside down out of humility because he didn't want to die like Jesus. Now, when you go look at the evidence, and this is just one example, the stories are so good, but when we actually look at the evidence, the idea that Peter said he wanted to be crucified upside down out of humility comes from centuries later. The actual story in which he's crucified upside down, he gives a very different explanation, and that story is from the second century. Now, in that story, the reason why Peter ends up drawing attention to himself is because he had been promoting celibacy to the courtesans and wives of the Roman elite. Now, that's very different than dying because you're professing the Trinity or something, or because you're professing Jesus and they kill you because you're a Christian. For a Roman emperor or a king or an official to try and have you executed because you have their favorite courtesan no longer having sex with them, that's sort of a very different motivation for killing someone. It's not really religious persecution. I'm not saying it's just, but it's certainly not the story that we heard.
Certainly they're still dying for their beliefs, though.
Are they? I mean, I don't know if you know, promoting celibacy between husbands and wives is a central tenet of Christianity.
Well, maybe not of Christianity, but it certainly was a part of his beliefs. And so in that sort of sense, they're still martyrs.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. Yes. He might be a martyr, but is he a martyr for Christianity? Mm-hmm. Because he's not dying because of Jesus. You know, no one, it's not as if that's what's eliciting his arrest. And it's not the case that the Romans go after him just because they hate Christians.
In fact, in 64, you write that really the term Christians didn't come into use until the second century, right?
That's right. Yeah. You know, in terms of Christians, almost all of the first century, the followers of Jesus saw themselves as Jews. And even once we start to see some division between the followers of Jesus and other groups of Jews at the time, they're still not using the term Christian yet. It doesn't seem as if they're using it until the very end of the first century. So could the Romans have even been targeting people for being Christians? Well, it seems highly unlikely, seeing as the Christians themselves aren't yet called Christians. It doesn't make sense that the Romans would even know about their existence as a separate group if Christians themselves think that they're the same as other Jews.
Now, we look at the story of the stoning of Stephen in Acts. Mm-hmm. I have to quibble a little bit because he's certainly professing a faith in Jesus that mm-hmm. is a Christian belief. And I think your analysis is that this was a dispute between Jews at this particular time. Am I summarizing your argument correctly?
Yes. The story of the death of Stephen is difficult because he gives this long speech. And when it comes to speech writing, ancient Greek historians tell us that if you don't know what someone said, you can just make it up. That was fine. You should write down what you think they should have said. So we have to wonder, is it the author or is it Stephen, given that the author wasn't present at the events? Now, with Stephen, he's actually stoned to death by other Jews for blasphemy. So certainly the Romans aren't involved here. Now, generally, Romans don't let Jews kill other Jews for blasphemy. So it's not really a well-organized event. It looks like lynching at best, and it would be a dispute between Jews and other Jews because it takes place so close to the death of Jesus. They're not Christians yet. I think we have to wonder about the presentation of the death of Stephen. I think Stephen likely existed and died, but we can't know precisely what happened because his death is described as being almost sort of, it parallels the death of Jesus in Luke almost exactly. And given that this is a major theme in Luke, That Luke likes to set up stories as paralleling one another.
And this occurs in Acts, which Luke is alleged to be the author of. Yes,
that's right. Luke is the author of both these books. Luke seems to be making a theological point about how the early church will be treated badly and persecuted just like Jesus. But whether the specific events transpired as Luke tells us they did in Acts, that's very difficult to say with any historical certainty. It seems as if Luke has sort of, let's say, embellished, altered, changed his sources. And the reason why this matters is that usually today, if you were going to put people on trial and accuse them of persecution, you would need better evidence. And if you were going to say that someone was a martyr, you would need to be sure about what they said and did and the circumstances of their death. Can you say, I believe this person was a martyr? Sure. Can you say Christians were being persecuted? We don't have the evidence for that.
Yeah. And this also gets into another part of the book where you're examining the story of persecution and martyrdom and persecution over the years, is that a lot of it had to do with the relationship between Christians and Romans. You know, they would be put on trial for not necessarily being a Christian, but as a result of their faith, they wouldn't profess allegiance to the Roman gods. They acted differently in court when they would come to court. And you really kind of describe some of it as sort of a cultural divide more than straight persecution.
Yeah, I think we have to try and understand what was going on in the minds of Romans when they did sentence Christians to die. And at the time, everyone agreed that sort of the flourishing of the empire or a community depended on the goodwill of the gods. So what everyone was trying to do was trying to get the gods to protect them from famine, from war, from disease. And the Romans felt, like most people, and the Romans were successful, that they had cultivated the favor of the gods through their own set of religious structures. And they were happy for you to have your own religious traditions as long as you didn't compromise or threaten that sort of delicate balance between human beings and the gods, as long as you weren't threatening the stability of the empire. But Christians would not participate in those structures. And they wouldn't, in fact, participate in all kinds of activities. They wouldn't, say, swear oaths, which is in the Bible, sure. But that meant you couldn't participate in business. You couldn't really be trusted to make an agreement with someone. It would sort of be like refusing to give your social security number to someone. And then when they were in courtrooms, they would say things like, well, I can't help support the Roman Empire through its religious structures, because I have my own emperor called Christ, and I can't respect anyone but Christ. And to a Roman, that made no sense. And when you start talking about how you have your own emperor, you have your own king, that starts to sound like revolutionary talk. And this is the Roman world. And in the Roman world, you could be sentenced to die for adultery or for writing a satirical song. So the idea of executing someone who's threatening the stability of the Roman Empire, who's countercultural, and who says things that sound like subversive revolutionary slogans, that was acceptable to all Romans.
Hmm. Even your book, though, admits there were times when there was persecution, say after 64 and the Great Fire of Rome. Nero blamed Christians. Later, several other emperors, Diocletian comes to mind, that there were times of persecution. What fomented these times of persecution?
Yes, there were times of persecution, and we do need to pay attention to those as we do today. In the case of the sort of real episodes of persecution, they all seem to have started in periods when the Roman Empire was under threat. So we tend to imagine when we look back that these are sort of tyrannical dictators with huge amounts of power, but Roman emperors actually were very vulnerable to assassination. The Roman Empire was constantly at war with outsiders. They called them barbarians. And so it was at particular moments when the political stability of the Roman Empire was in question that the Romans would initiate these periods of actual persecution. The Diocletian persecution, some of the letters that have the rules in them, the new laws that limited the legal rights of Christians, for instance, were precipitated by uprisings in which Christians were implicated. So the Romans felt that there was an immediate threat, and the way to deal with that threat, and to both in terms of the Christians perhaps being political revolutionaries and in terms of cultivating the favor of the gods, was to persecute the Christians.
My guest today is Candida Moss. She teaches New Testament and Early Christianity Studies at the University of Notre Dame. Her book is titled The Myth of Persecution: How Early Christians Invented a Story of Martyrdom. Well, for some Christians, this book is going to be interesting, but really of no great consequence. But for others, this is a direct challenge to their faith. I was struck by something you wrote about attending one of your first divinity classes that your teacher said, of course these all happened. You know, Christ's resurrection, they had to have witnessed this. Why would they sacrifice their lives if he hadn't? So for those folks that find this a direct challenge to their faith, what would you say to them about these events?
Here is what I'd say. When I wrote the book, I wrote it because I wanted there to be better dialogue. I thought that Christians need to stop claiming that they're persecuted and defend their opinions logically and reasonably, and keep persecution language for those who are persecuted. With respect to the claim that many Christians make that the apostles wouldn't have suffered and died if they hadn't witnessed the resurrection, I would say that's just not a good argument. You know, we know that people will suffer and die for lots of things now, lots of things that Christians don't believe in, other religions, for instance. So that's just not a good argument. And I would say that we don't have the evidence to know if the apostles even had a choice about whether or not they would die. And surely that's key. If they're just murdered, then we can't really make that claim anyway. We can talk about having faith in martyrs. We can say that there were martyrs. We can respect them. We can venerate them. We can extol their virtues and say, be courageous like the martyrs. I'm all for that. What I think we have to stop saying is using the martyrs to construct this history and sense of ourselves in which we're constantly persecuted, because we don't have the evidence for that. And because that idea casts such long shadows over the history of Christianity, I think that this is one place where we really have to get our facts straight.
And as the conflicts and disagreements between devout Christians and others continue today, how should they let this new view of early church history guide themselves in those debates and arguments?
Well, there were some Christians who, when it came to negotiating with the Roman Empire, tried to explain themselves using the sort of terms and imagery of contemporary culture. They wouldn't concede their beliefs. They wouldn't change their beliefs. But they were conciliatory in terms of trying to explain their arguments to others and trying to enter into real productive dialogue and collaborate on contentious issues. And I think that if we're going to retrieve something from the early church, that's the model that we should be taking. I'm not suggesting that anyone give up their beliefs, but I think we need to change the way that we talk about ourselves and relate to other people.
Hmm. The name of the book is The Myth of Persecution. Candida Moss, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Rich.
Candida Moss is a professor of New Testament and Early Christianity Studies at the University of Notre Dame in Indiana. Her new book is titled The Myth of Persecution: How Early Christians Invented a Story of Martyrdom. It's published by Harper One. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent programs, they're available online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.